You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Do you think that eating a low-fat diet is the best way to keep your weight down and your heart healthy? Well, according to Nina Teicholz, a science journalist who – who has spent the last 9 years studying the research behind our national recommended dietary guidelines, it may be time to think again. In her book, The Big Fat Surprise, Ms. Teicholz argues that several now widely accepted truths, primarily that we should avoid saturated fats and eating meat and use olive oil and eat mainly plants instead, are completely wrong. And she concludes that our current obesity and diabetes epidemics have been caused not by the public's failure to stick to a low-fat diet, but by sticking to it too closely. Nina Teicholz's work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Economist, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal. Her book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm already preparing myself for all the angry mail I'm going to receive after this discussion. Should I ask the listeners to address their letters to you instead?
That's fine. Forward it to me.
Have you concluded that most of us would be better off following the Atkins or the paleo diet or one of those similar diets rather than a low-fat vegetarian or even a vegan diet?
You know, the short answer is really yes. There have been, over the last decade really, a large number of really rigorous clinical trials looking at this question that has bedeviled us for so long, you know, for decades really, since Atkins and Ornish, and you know, there have been a lot of diet doctors, a lot of flip-flopping advice. But the last decade has really seen a large number of rigorous clinical trials that have looked at all kinds of populations and compared low-fat diets to high-fat diets. And in terms of every marker of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, people look healthier on all those measures on a high-fat diet.
But it seems counterintuitive.
I
would think that a low-fat, plant-based diet would be the best.
That has been so ingrained in us, it just seems like intuitively common sense now. I mean, that recommendation has – the first recommendation against saturated fats, the fats found in meat, cheese, eggs, dairy that recommendation goes back to 1961. The first one was made by the American Heart Association in that year. And so we've been on this diet for a little over half a century. Our health has gotten measurably worse. We've complied with that recommendation. We eat 25% more carbohydrates than we did in the early 70s. We eat 11% less saturated fat. We eat 17% more fruits and vegetables since the early 70s, but we're sicker.
And you say that you've been looking at all of the research over those past 50 or so years and found much of it to be flawed. Was there much research into the efficacy of diets like the Atkins?
Atkins is such an interesting story because in the early 70s when he became popular, there was no science then on this. There was historical evidence that people in, you know, the Inuit in the Arctic had lived on high-fat diets there was an absence of heart disease and diabetes, but there hadn't been any clinical trials. And
that could have been a genetic thing.
Right, that could have been – that was actually studied, and the Inuit aren't the only example. There are other tribes that have been found and documented in Africa and other places. But Atkins, who was probably not a great representative of his point of view, he was – an irascible figure.
I found him charming when he was a guest on our show.
Well, good. I've heard about him from a number of people, and maybe I think he did become paranoid over the years because he was called a quack and a faddist. But there were he only had his patients' files to point to. That's the important thing. And those can only be anecdotal. But since then, the science has been done.
And when he died in 2003, after he'd fallen and hit his head and lapsed into a coma, some of his critics spread rumors that he had died of a heart attack.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the really shocking things about my research, and I did go back and looked at all of the early studies, is just what I call like nutrition science's blood sport. I mean, there has been a lot of slander and name calling, and it's a really important topic, and you know, I think that some of the slanderous things said about Atkins fall into that description, but he was not obese and didn't have a heart attack.
So what happened when you call some people to interview them and they figured out your position? Were they open with you or were they hostile to you?
You know, I've been working on this book for so long. When I started out 9 years ago, the research community was much more closed than it is today. So there had been the work of one really important science journalist named Gary Taubes. And when I would call people and they would say to me, you know, if you're going to take the Gary Taubes line, I don't want to talk to you. And I had to be careful about what I said and what I asked them about. That I've seen really a noticeable shift over the last 8 years.
Well, he had published first in Science magazine.
Right.
And then he wrote a cover story for the New York Times magazine, published a popular book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. But that didn't convince people in the nutrition community?
No. Gary Taubes was the origin of everybody thinking maybe it's not fat. Maybe it's sugar or carbohydrates instead. He began all of that. His science article is like a landmark article for nutrition. And since, although his book was not recognized so much in the media, it was read widely by nutrition researchers, and they started doing clinical trials that had never been done. And so the science that has accumulated over the last decade is really owing to him.
Didn't a Women's Health Initiative study, which recently followed 49,000 women for 10 years, conclude that the low-fat diet was actually failing women?
Yes. The results came out in 2006, and actually that trial had almost 50,000 women in it, and it began in the late 1990s, and it was the largest ever trial of the low-fat diet. And there really had been almost no trials before then, and the results were a resounding failure for the low-fat diet. It made no difference in terms of any kind of cancer or heart disease or diabetes or obesity.
Does it matter whether it's men or women or children?
Absolutely. I mean, women get heart disease differently than men do. They're because of their hormones. The whole etiology of heart disease is different for them. Children, because they're growing, they have different nutritional needs. The story of our dietary recommendations is really taking the dietary advice for middle-aged men who were trying to prevent heart disease and recommending it to all women and children over the age of 2.
A new film by Katie Couric and Laura David argues that sugar is often put into foods to replace the flavor that's lost when fat is removed to make low-fat foods. And sugar is a major reason that people with weight problems can't lose weight through low-fat diets and exercise. And they concentrate on women and kids. And some of these kids are doing everything possible to get their weight down, and nothing seems to work.
It's very hard to lose weight on a low-fat diet. It's hard for anybody, not just women and children. Sugar is part of the problem, but it doesn't really matter what kind of carbohydrate it – I mean, according to the science has looked – I mean, that Women's Health Initiative study, it looked at women who were following the USDA recommendations. They weren't eating a lot, you know, sugar every day. They were eating fruits, vegetables, whole grains. So – and that's a high-carbohydrate diet. So people on a high-carbohydrate diet, even if they're – if it's unrefined carbohydrates, have been shown to not fare as well.
My guest – is Nina Teicholz. Her book, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Can you tell us about the theory behind the low-fat diet known as the diet heart hypothesis?
Yes. So this is really interesting. The diet heart hypothesis basically states that saturated fat raises your cholesterol then gives you heart disease. It goes back to the 1950s when the nation was really fearful of the heart disease epidemic, which had appeared out of nowhere and had suddenly become, you know, over the previous few decades had become the number one killer in America. And there were a number of competing theories about why that was true, what was causing heart disease. There was one man, Ansel Benjamin Keys, a pathologist from the University of Minnesota, who proposed the idea that it was saturated fat. He ran the biggest nutrition study of the 1950s, and eventually he got that idea implanted in the American Heart Association, and that was the beginning of that hypothesis being fact.
Well, there was a whole matter of good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, and saturated fats were giving us bad cholesterol.
In those days, in the 1950s, it was just total cholesterol. They couldn't measure good and bad in those days.
Now, this Dr. Keyes, who seems to me as much the villain of this book as if we were talking about this as a mystery novel, he is the K on K rations, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He became so famous.
Every GI hated the man.
I don't actually know it was in K rations, but he had a very charismatic, aggressive personality. He was called arrogant even by his friends, and he had a way of getting his ideas, adopted, and he ended up on the cover of Time magazine. He was highly, highly influential in his day, and it's true that I think it's important to say you can't say that one man caused everything. All of our dietary recommendations that we have today, there have certainly been lots of studies that have been done and other scientists who have weighed in. And part of what I do in my book is really describe the whole history.
But you call the research that Keyes conducted and used to support the hypothesis faulty. Why? In what way was it faulty? Was he not following normal scientific procedures?
He really wasn't. He conducted what was called the Seven Country Study, which is... it's like the big bang of nutrition research. It was on almost 13,000 men all over Europe. And the idea was to show, and in Japan and the U.S., and the idea was to show that heart disease was not something that would inevitably happen. There was variations, and you could maybe prevent it. And so there are many methodological flaws in his studies, and I dug back into that research to find some of them. One of them was that when he visited the Cretan islanders, who were like his star subjects, they had ate very little saturated fat. They seemed to live very long lives. They suffered very little heart disease. One of the three study periods that he looked at them, he went during Lent when they were avoiding meat and cheese and dairy. And he also, because his survey data didn't work out for various reasons, he ended up throwing out that survey data and using other kinds of data, but it was only on like 64 men in Greece. That's part of the problem. And I can tell you one other problem with his study that's sort of a fundamental flaw, which is that he selected his countries that he was choosing for those seven countries. He chose ones that would fit into his hypothesis. So like he didn't choose France or Switzerland or West Germany, also populations who suffered very little heart disease, but ate a lot of saturated fat. So those were fundamental problems in his research.
Is this where we get the Mediterranean diet from?
It is also. Those Cretan islanders are the foundation of the Mediterranean diet. I mean, Ansel Keys, in his day, he created the idea of a Mediterranean diet, but he didn't really promote it or push it in any way. It was later picked up by researchers in Italy and Greece and then at Harvard University in the late 1980s.
So olive oil isn't better for our health?
Olive oil, it's a whole big story about olive oil and the Mediterranean diet that I talk about in my book. But olive oil, the idea, the science that underpins the whole idea about olive oil somehow being heart healthy was funded by the International Olive Oil Council. They sort of got this whole idea of the Mediterranean diet going by sending a lot of research scientists to fantastic free vacations all over the Mediterranean. And olive oil, it turns out, after a tremendous amount of studies that have been done, scientists are unable to conclude that it really spares people from heart disease.
That it has exceptional disease-fighting properties.
Exactly.
That we've been told it does. So it was really a trade lobby that made that more popular. What about didn't they pay for travel junkets to the Mediterranean for scientific researchers during the winter so that they could do that kind of research?
There was like a whole decade from 1993 on when the Mediterranean diet conference circuit was like the hot ticket in nutrition. Food writers, chefs, nutrition scientists, government officials, and they got together for these unprecedentedly fantastic conferences all over the Mediterranean, and that's why that concept became so popular.
What about other vegetable oils, or Well, we consume a lot of soybean, don't we? 1,000 times more than we did 100 years ago.
Right. Vegetable oils only came into the American diet in the early part of the 20th century. It first came in a hardened form as Crisco in 1911, and then in regular bottle form. That became common in the 1940s. So we went from
And then we were told that margarines were healthier than butter.
Right.
Which is vegetable oil.
Well, when companies started making vegetable oils, they had to convince American housewives to get rid of butter and lard, which is what they had been using before for all of the nation's history, and switch to vegetable oils.
And now an awful lot of people use corn and canola oil. In fact, we often have recipes telling us to use canola oil.
The problem with vegetable oils are that they are not stable at high temperatures. They oxidize. They create oxidation products that cause inflammation and other problems that really have not been talked about much and I think need to be.
My guest is Nina Teicholz, who's written for Gourmet Magazine, The New Yorker, The Economist, The New York Times, The Washington Post. She has a new book called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese belong in a Healthy Diet, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Nina Teicholz. Her book, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Weren't you a restaurant reviewer before you started doing this work?
I was a small-time restaurant reviewer. I was reviewing restaurants for a little throwaway paper on the Upper West Side and in New York City. And we didn't have a budget for paying for meals, so I just had to eat whatever the chef wanted to send out for me. And what I discovered was that chefs were not interested in sending out stir-fry vegetables and chicken breasts, which is what I had been eating for most of my adult life, and fish. Instead, they want to send out foods like red meat, pate, cream sauces, organ meats that, you know, a lot of these foods I had never tasted before. I found them earthy, textured, rich, interesting. My cholesterol levels stayed the same, and lost the stubborn 10 pounds I had been fighting for a long time. And I, as a journalist, I wanted to know, you know, what was this mystery? I didn't understand it.
Well, chefs come in all sizes, but I've always been surprised by how many of them are thin, considering the fact that I see them as always being in the way of temptation. And they're eating their own food, which often has a lot of butter and other things that like meats and stuff.
Well, eating those foods doesn't make you fat. I mean, the idea that the fat that you see in marbled beef is going to be the fat that winds up on your body is the fat, you know, that is just one of these tragic homonyms. The fat you eat is the fat that you get. And that turns out, after it's been tested in clinical trials, not to be true.
Now, you know, I'm already getting a lot of angry mail from vegetarians and vegans. Sometimes when we do shows with vegetarians and vegans, we get complaints from people who eat a lot of meat that we're not mentioning the Atkins diet. So you can't win in this conversation. But what do you say to those people?
I think it's perfectly, you can be healthy without eating meat. You can eat eggs, you can eat cheese, you can eat whole milk, you don't have
to. But vegans don't eat most of those things either.
It's very hard to be healthy on a vegan diet. It's just hard. I mean, it's in the animal studies that they did in the 1920s and 30s looking at omnivore animals, they found that it's not impossible to stay healthy on that diet, but combining all the grains and seeds and beans and everything in the right proportions made it exceedingly difficult.
Now, the American Heart Association, you mentioned earlier, and actually refused to endorse Ansel Keys' hypothesis during the 1950s when he first proposed it. But then it became the basis for the association's recommendations. Were they just going along with what everybody else was believing?
No, they were the first to propose it in 1961 when they proposed the first anti-saturated fat nutritional guidelines. Their guidelines really became the gold standard for Americans. But They have a nutrition committee. It's a small group of scientists. Ansel Keys got on it along with Jerry Stamler, and those two men were able to steer the committee around. And the AHA, it's important to say, they really felt the urgency of responding to the heart disease crisis. It really felt like a crisis to them, and they were well-intentioned in trying to respond to it.
But the die-heart hypothesis is also adopted by the National Institutes of Health.
It was. I mean, the National Institute of Health and the American Heart Association are like twin organizations. They worked in concert with each other very closely. The people who were leaders of one became leaders of the other. They had the same – they had joint expert panels, or their scientists would serve in each other's institutions. And they were – they together guided this hypothesis in – they institutionalized it.
Since the 1970s, we've increased our consumption of fruits and vegetables by 17%, increased grains by 29%, cut fat consumption by 43% to 33% of calories, and our health is getting worse. And yet at the same time, I still want to eat grains, fruits, and vegetables. I like the fiber. I like the taste. I believe in the vitamins I'm getting from vegetables and fruits. So is there some kind of a compromise here?
I think we have just shifted too far in over to – now we have a diet. The one that's recommended by the USDA is over 60% carbohydrates. The giant bottom slab of the USDA food pyramid is bread, pasta, other kinds of, you know, grains. And I think we've just shifted too far in that direction. It's perfectly possible to have those foods in your diet, just not so much of them.
When the low-fat, low-cholesterol diet was officially recommended to the public, the American Heart Association in 1961 – 1 in 7 American adults were obese. That number is now 1 in 3. The rate of diabetes has risen from 1% to 11%.
I mean, those are scary numbers. And
can we blame that totally on this diet, 11%?
I mean, you know, I don't know. But I think that you have to look at those numbers, which look terrible. And you look at the fact that Americans have been complying with the recommended diet that has been given to us by the AHA and the USDA and ask, like, is this hypothesis about this diet working for us?
But what happened to the normally self-correcting mechanisms of science, which involve constantly challenging accepted beliefs?
So science requires you to constantly, right, doubt yourself, challenge and question your own hypothesis. I think institutions, it's very hard to do science in an institution. I've come to believe that institutional science is almost an oxymoron, because when you're an institution, you do the opposite of science. You need to be constant. You need to not flip-flop for your public. You need to have consistency. That is the you can't stay nimble, especially when you get the entire federal government behind a hypothesis, as the USDA and the Senate did. You've got then the whole wheels of government behind one idea, and it's very hard to change.
We talked earlier about oils, and a lot of our listeners have asked about coconut and palm oils, the tropical oils, whether they are bad for us or good for us.
You know, one of the sections that I love in my book is I describe why we came to believe that tropical oils are bad for us. That happened in the late 1980s when basically the American Soybean Association ran a slander campaign against palm and coconut oil because it was a trade campaign because they're having a trade war and they wanted to get rid of especially palm imports, because palm oil does it's competitive with vegetable oils. And that slander campaign worked. It worked incredibly well. And Americans believe that coconut oil and palm oil will kill you. And that turns out not to be even remotely true.
Has it been a problem for research scientists when they propose certain studies that go against the conventional wisdom?
Yes.
Were they finding it harder to get funding to look into these hypotheses?
Yeah, I mean, there have been critics of this hypothesis all along. That's important to say. It's not as if nobody spoke out against it. They did. But they found that it was then hard to get research dollars, they weren't invited to conferences, they weren't invited on to be on expert committees. There's one scientist I spoke to, George Mann, who is a very prominent critic of Ansel Keys, and one day he was in the National Institute of Health, and the secretary pulled him out in the hall and said, you know, if you continue your opposition to Ansel Keys, you're going to lose your grant. And he did. And it got to a point where scientists would just self-censor. They just wouldn't go into the field. That's that silence I talk about when I call up researchers and they don't even want to talk about it, because it became like professional suicide to go against the conventional wisdom about fat.
Can you explain in a layperson's terms how eating carbohydrates affects our bodies?
Yes. Yeah, so carbohydrates break down into grains and starchy vegetables break down into glucose in the bloodstream. Glucose triggers, it causes the liver to release insulin. Insulin is like the king of all hormones for storing fat. If you eat carbohydrates all day long, starting with a glass of orange juice and oatmeal in the beginning of your day, maybe you have, you know, a granola bar and then you have pasta for dinner, you've constantly got insulin in your system and your body never gets to recover from that. And then there's the other kind of the other sugar is fructose, which is in fruit. That is less to do with insulin. It's more about the havoc that it wrecks on your liver and messes up your various kinds of cholesterol measures.
And insulin is connected to diabetes.
And if you are chronically exposed to insulin, you become insulin resistant, basically, and that's the beginning of diabetes.
Didn't a study done in the 1980s show that women with high cholesterol lived longer than women with low cholesterol?
You know, that's part of this tragic women and children who got, you know, like dragged along into the recommendations for middle-aged men. Women had never been studied. And the one study on them, it's called the Framingham study, when their results came out in 1971, it turned out that women over 50, the higher cholesterol they had, the longer they lived. Well, that result, which was so counterintuitive, wasn't in the study conclusions because it just violated everything that everybody thought at the time.
I'm sure that some of our listeners have all sorts of questions, and I'm going to invite a few to call in. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. The number again, 212-433-9692. I'm speaking with Nina Teicholz. Her book, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. It is published by Simon & Schuster. What has been the response so far to this book? People saying, at last, somebody who has looked at all the research, or are they saying, oh, somebody else with an axe to grind?
Well, I'm sure there's going to be a big blowback to what I'm saying, because obviously it's so controversial. But because the health authorities basically don't allow conversations about high-fat diets, there has been the blogosphere is – there's a huge paleosphere in the blog and the online world that has been talking about this for, you know, really a good 5 years. They have conferences, magazines. I mean, it's really out there. So for them, they're elated.
Jessica in Staten Island asks, what would be the ideal oil for frying those occasional chicken cutlets with mustard sauce?
So a solid fat, which is saturated, does not oxidize easily at high temperatures, and coconut oil is a good one. And you can go back to using what American housewives used to use, which is butter or lard. Those are really good, stable fats. They don't oxidize at high temperatures. And, you know, secondarily, I would say olive oil.
But you're not against olive oil. You just think that saying olive oil is the answer to all of our problems.
Right. It's not really the elixir for health that it's been portrayed to be, but it's fine.
Well, when you're at a restaurant and they bring out a little dish of olive oil, do you say, could you bring out some butter? That's what I do.
I like olive oil, but I love butter. I think it's delicious. So both are fine.
Let's take some calls. Judy from Port Washington. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a woman over 50. Should I throw out my statin medications?
You do write about statins here as well.
I do a little. I mean, I haven't done a thorough research job on statins. All I would say is that the statin industry has influenced the nutrition industry because the pharmaceutical industry knows how to lower LDL. And LDL was like one of the points that convicted saturated fats because saturated fats raise LDL. Saturated fats also raise your good cholesterol. And it turns out that our understanding of heart disease was rather primitive when we targeted only LDL. Now we know about many other things that are far more sophisticated, like lipoprotein A and other things I won't go into. But saturated fat does not wreak havoc on your cholesterol measures in the way that we've thought it to.
Let's go to Gail now. Gail from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I'm very interested in this topic because my mother, who lived to be over 85, had a 300 cholesterol all her life. I have been promoting with friends the notion that cholesterol and doctors who want to put you on statins, most of my friends are on statins. We are in our mid-70s. It's just, I guess one question is, how do they defat all these non-fat products? Has anyone given any attention to what is the defatting process?
Yes. In fact, what they do, so fat provides texture, flavor, and when they take out fat out of products like yogurt, salad dressing, they have to use what's called fat replacers. And fat replacers are almost always carbohydrate-based, and sometimes they're just sugar. So those low-fat products are much higher in carbohydrates.
Because when you take the fat out, you're also taking flavor out.
You're
the
taking
sugar
out flavor
and
texture.
Salt are wind up being the replacements often.
That's right.
Andrew, hi, you're on the air. Andrew from Huntington, Long Island.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit more about how the vegan option was kind of quickly dismissed earlier. I'm in the name of self-disclosure here. My whole family were all vegan. We're very healthy, and I don't think it's too difficult. And I think there are just also bigger implications, environmental implications and animal rights and suffering implications and factory farming implications. And I think it was quickly dismissed, maybe unfairly.
Okay.
So there are sort of two points there. One is that, what is the necessity of having saturated? You can get your saturated fats from coconut oil. It's important to have some saturated fats because they're essential to health. They don't necessarily have to come from animal foods. The environmental and ethical questions about eating meat are enormous. And it's taken me almost a decade just to try to figure out what's healthy. I think we need to ask, what is healthy? What will spare us obesity, diabetes, and heart disease and the load of chronic disease in our nation? And then let's figure out how to make that sustainable.
Some listeners have wondered about whether it's important to focus on buying pasture-raised animals and dairy products, if that has a health benefit.
Again, not really my expertise. I think it's if you can afford it, it's great to buy the best possible meat and dairy and eggs and cheese that you possibly can. And I hope that I just think not everybody can afford it. You just do what you can.
Michelle, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say a few things. I agree with the woman who was on right before this call. I am in the medical field. I am 62. I have excellent labs, no problems with cholesterol, et cetera. Years ago, I stopped eating all of the high fats, high protein, the meats, et cetera, and went on a modified vegetarian diet with the grains, the veggies, lots of fruit. I ended up getting deathly ill. My cholesterol went sky high, produced excessive cholesterol crystals, and had to have my gallbladder taken out. When I went back on my, which is considered now the paleo diet, modified Atkins, I did fine. Whenever I went off of it, I gained weight. Back on it, I lose weight and build muscle. I really, really believe that. I hate saying it, but when you take a look around, when you think about the agribusiness, the pharmaceutical companies, the pyramid that came into effect many years ago, right after that is really when we saw the increase in all of these problems with diabetes, hypertension.
Nina?
Well, your experience is one that a lot of people have, and there are a lot of anecdotes out there like yours. I would say that the important thing is really to do science. To really look at these issues in clinical trials, and that's what's the important evidence we can point to.
But haven't people assumed that eating too much fat is what has been clogging people's arteries and damaging their hearts?
Well, that's been the working hypothesis. But
So what is causing this rise in bypass operations?
What causes I think the best candidate for what is causing heart disease and obesity and diabetes is this. They all cluster. They come together at the same time and they coexist in humans and they arrive in human populations at the same time when the populations that are isolated before they import products from overseas. Those products are carbohydrates. Sugar, jam, white flour, and I think the best hypothesis now is that those are the foods that cause those diseases.
The book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. It's posted by Simon & Schuster. My great thanks to Nina Teicholz for being our guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.